Trigger warning. This podcast addresses deeply rooted and challenging topics. It is written for open-minded individuals who are seeking insight and alternative perspectives on the complex histories of cults and their leaders. Many cults are destructive, and some of the content presented here may be emotionally triggering. This podcast is not recommended for young people, as some content may be inappropriate. Listener discretion advised. Welcome to Cult Following.
The Solar Temple gained worldwide notoriety after 74 of its members were found dead in Switzerland, Canada, and France between 1994 and 1997. Several of the victims were shot or asphyxiated in what were apparently ritual murders, although some are thought to have been willing participants in these mass suicides. Among the dead were the two founders of the sect. The two men apparently milked followers of their money and convinced them that they must die in order to attain bliss in the afterworld. This is the Order of the Solar Temple Cult on today's episode of Cult Following. And I am Dr. Katie.
Hi, Dr. Katie. How are you today?
I am doing well. How are you?
Good, good. Great open. This is exciting. I'm looking forward to today's.
Yes, me too. This should be really interesting. A little bit of a deviation from our last couple of episodes.
So our normal murderous cults.
Yes.
On the day that we're recording this, on July 28th, we actually have some cult-related news. So, you know, we've been teasing this Nexium cult, you know, as long as we've been doing these podcasts. We've been, personally, you and I have been following Nexium for a long time. And over the last few weeks, few months, verdicts have been coming down and people have been getting punished. So today, we got the sentence for Lauren Salzman, who was Keith Raniere's basically right-hand woman. And interestingly enough, she got probation and 300 hours of community service. So crazy. I mean, I don't even know if I can believe this, that it was so light. So they said she was extraordinarily, she was of extraordinary assistance to the prosecutors. So she got virtually no sentence.
Yeah, very interesting to me that she got a slap on the wrist, essentially, especially compared to, you know, some of the other people that were pretty heavily involved in that cult.
Not even a monetary fine. Like we just saw a couple weeks ago, there was a monetary fine that was delivered to Keith. And then of course, Allison Mack got a relatively light sentence. And, and I think this is interesting being that these were women who recruited other women into essentially the sex cult part of what Nexium was. The women aren't getting, they're getting light punishments for branding and bringing women into a sex cult. I find that really fascinating.
That is really interesting. And I'm hoping that, you know, once we get into that specific piece of Nexium, when we're able to record those episodes, that we take a look at that and, you know, is there a difference when there's somebody that is a woman or female member of a cult that's, you know, high up with the leaders? Is that something that makes a difference as far as how they're punished when caught? And how they interact with the other cult members, especially if it's, you know, a woman with other women.
Yeah. Yeah. We're used to seeing men get punished for these kind of these vulgar activities against women in these types of sex, any type of cult, really. You see that a lot. But this is one of the first times we really see women that were in charge of portions of the cult that had basically perpetrated crimes against other women. And it's very, for the first time, we're really seeing punishments being handed down. And it, at least for me, this seems very light. So,
I had the same feeling. So I look forward to talking about that as well.
Before we get into the Order of the Solar Temple, I just want to say one other thing, and that is to thank our subscribers and listeners. Dr. Katie and I are overjoyed by the response we've gotten to this podcast. So we think we both really want to thank all of you that are listening and tell your friends about it.
Yes, very, very, very much so. Very grateful. I'm really glad that people are enjoying it so far. And anytime that someone tells me that they've listened, I always thank them. And I truly genuinely mean that. So thank you all for listening. And yeah, make sure that if you enjoy it, that you give us a rating and subscribe. That makes a huge difference for us as far as getting our name out there. So we would greatly appreciate that as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you want me to tell you a little bit about the origin of the Order of the Solar Temple?
Definitely. I'm ready.
All right. Let's get into this. The International Chivalric Order solar tradition was a destructive doomsday cult founded by Luc Jouret in 1984. It absorbed the Foundation Golden Way, which was led by Joseph de Mambro. So Joseph and Luc were the two founders of this Order of the Solar Temple. Jouret himself, he believed himself to be Christ, and he assumed much of the public leadership, where de Mambro kind of convinced members that he was a member of the 14th century Christian Order of the Knights Templar, which is really interesting to me. During a kind of a previous life, and he believed that his daughter Emmanuelle was the cosmic child, which we don't really have much information on what he meant by that. It seems odd, very hippie-ish, but you know, the cosmic child is kind of weird and different. Together, Jouret and de Mambro convinced followers that they would lead them after death to a planet which revolves around the star Sirius. They regard death as an illusion and that life continues on other planets. Solar temple groups were organized in Quebec, Canada, as well as Australia, Switzerland, and other countries. They follow a form of Christianity mixed with New Age philosophy, homeopathic medicine, and high finance. So this is just kind of our brief teaser on it. We're going to get into a lot more details on this order, but I'm curious, Dr. Katie. So Jouret believed he was Christ. Initial thoughts?
I just want to make a quick comment about the cosmic child, because I feel like that should be put up for grabs as a potential new Ben and Jerry's flavor.
Ben and Jerry's is listening. We are open to sponsorship.
Exactly. Feel like that's what that made me think of initially. Maybe I just like ice cream. So this is really something that seems to come up a lot in the cults that we have looked at, this, you know, grandiose idea that as a member of this cult or as a leader of a cult, that you are Christ or Christ-like or some divine entity. And it just really speaks to me again to that level of grandiosity and potentially delusion. I mean, we'll get into it a little more as we talk more about the details of this cult, but those are the two things that pop up for me. Is there anything that comes to mind when you read that?
You know, we're going to see a lot in episodes to come, and we've seen this already. Even with Manson, there's a lot of these heads of these cults that feel like they are Christ-like figures. They are Christ returned. There's a lot of this that goes on, and you know, I'm not one to diagnose this kind of thing. Is a person, is there something clinically wrong with them when they have a Christ complex like that? And also in terms of how far they take it, do they live and act out their world like that person, or are these businessmen during the day, but they're like, hey, I was Christ in a past life. Like, I don't really know. And there aren't a lot of people left alive that knew these people that could validate this for us. But I do have kind of a similar route to take with de Mambro. You know, he claims he had a past life as a member of the Knights Templar. And I'm curious, you know, is something like this an act? Is he just putting on an act? Is it a show? Is it a play for, you know, his members? Or does this guy have a psychological condition? I'm not sure, and maybe you can answer this, but is there actually data out there on people that have sought therapy that have past life memories, or is this some form of schizophrenia? Is there some medical way to approach this, Dr. Katie?
There is. I mean, I believe I've mentioned this before in previous episodes, but I like to think of everything as being on a spectrum for the most part. And so in psychology, I think about different traits and different disorders as also being on the spectrum. So I would say there are really a number of different potential psychological conditions or disorders that might be associated with these thoughts of grandiosity or delusions, or even these past life memories that they speak about. And so we would really need a lot more information. So, I mean, you know, just thinking off the top of my head, bipolar 1 disorder includes grandiosity and delusions and that kind of thing, especially during a manic episode, as does, you know, narcissistic personality disorder. Schizophrenia has both delusions and hallucinations. That's what the biggest components of that disorder. And so it really could also potentially be that, or it could just be an act, right? If I tell you that I was this big important person in a past life, then you might be more likely to believe that I am also this big important person or this divine being or divine entity, or, you know, some cosmic being that has some higher level of power than all of these other earthly beings. And you might be more likely to be manipulated to doing what I want you to do. And so, you know, then that gets more into that psychopathology that we talked about previously with psychopathy. And so there are a lot of different potential disorders or conditions that could be associated with these things. I don't have any specifics on past life memories, but I know that there is data on those. And I think, you know, with something like that, it's really, really hard to prove whether or not that's actually true, because all we can do is look at accounts of people who have been regressed in therapy, undergone hypnosis and come up with these past life memories. So is that something that's been created or planted, or, just kind of a combination of things that your brain comes up with when you're put under hypnosis? I don't know.
Let me ask you this, just maybe for the layman out there in the world listening to us. If I were to come into your office and I say, Dr. Katie, I'm haunted by this thing. Like I was a farmer in Germany in 1412, and, you know, I watched my wife get murdered, you know, and I can't shake this, that I was living as this person. Like, what do you do to me at that point? How do you approach that? If I'm have these deep, you know, these dreams and these fantasies or these recollections of things that happened a long time ago, how do you address that?
There's a whole process, but I would say, I like to start out with, you know, doing a clinical interview where I get a lot more information about where these thoughts originated, or when you first had this come up for you, and, you know, what the rest of your life currently has been like, and your childhood and all that. So get as much information about your life from you subjectively as I can. And then I would move on to probably doing fair number of assessments. So, personality assessments, definitely for something like this is a good start. That way we can get an idea of is this potentially just some kind of psychopathology, or is this person really kind of falling in what we consider to be the normal range for things, but they're just plagued by this, you know, or is this anxiety? So really weeding it out that way. And then I would probably spend some more time talking to the person about what they wanted to get out of coming to talk to me about this, right? Do they want to know if they have a disorder? Do they just want to talk through this? Do they want to try to figure it out? And do they feel like they need to know that this is something that actually happened, or do they not need to know that? And they can just kind of rely on their own account of things that they feel that this really is something that happened, and that they really just want to come in and try to get some help with finding, you know, some coping skills to deal with the anxiety that's coming up around this so that they can live a happy and healthy life. And even though they would still have this idea that this happened or this memory as they see it, that they would be able to live this life, you know, in a healthy and happy way without this continuing to interfere. So that, sure, that would be the approach that I would take.
Now, see, I write a lot about kind of the cyclical existence of the soul and reincarnation. I write about that in my book, and I've studied that a lot, and I've met a lot of people with past life experiences. And so I find that very fascinating. The thing that I think is also fascinating is how people always come back as someone who was famous or important in the past. No one really comes back as, I was a farmer, you know, like no one has that lame of a job that talk about their past lives. And maybe there's a reason for that. But, you know, like this guy, you know, come back as Christ, you come back as someone in this really important, you know, Christian order that historically was very important. But, you know, the Buddhists, that's their thing. It's, you know, you keep coming back and you keep living your life until you've done it right. So there's 535 million Buddhists in the world. So this idea of maybe you were something in the past, there could be something to that, I think.
Yeah, I really find that fascinating as well, to be honest. And I've done some research of my own into Zen Buddhism, and there are a lot of things that we use in psychology and, you know, practices that we use that are rooted in Eastern philosophy and religion, actually. And so that's something that I think about on a fairly frequent basis. I mean, even just at the level of, you know, mindfulness and working a lot with people, helping them to be present in their lives now. But yeah, this idea of samsara and this cycle of life and death and rebirth, is really fascinating to think about. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but,
I have a little bit more information. So there's not a lot known about Dimambro, but I did find some additional information on Luc Jarret. And I thought this was really interesting. And this was a kind of a last minute addition to the data I had sent you previously. But so, you know, he was born in Belgian Congo. And, you know, we know him historically as this cult leader. But here's what's really interesting when I started to really go into his backstory. He actually co-founded several other groups before he ever did this. And it's real. I'm going to tell you a little bit about kind of where, what led him where. He was actually a leading member of a neo-Nazi Belgian group, which I thought was interesting that this guy had a lot of neo-Nazi values. Yeah. During his college years, he joined a communist youth group. Also interesting. Which resulted in the police actually placing him under surveillance for a long period of his life. He traveled the world studying various forms of alternative and spiritual healing. He lectured as he was doing this. He lectured on communism. He lectured on neo-Nazi kind of their doctrine and their hate doctrine that they had. He also talked about holistic health and the paranormal in his lectures. And it's through these lectures that he actually came across Joseph Dimambro. So he lectured at the Golden Way Foundation, which was a New Age group in Geneva. And that's when he became close friends with that foundation leader, Joseph Dimambro. And then basically what they did was they shut down the Golden Way Foundation and they created this Order of the Solar Temple. But the interesting thing is the Golden Way Foundation actually had a lot of, occult activity in it. So this, all the stuff was kind of brought into the Solar Temple just through, you know, the way Luke traveled the world and his ideology. So he was possibly a troubled, searching young person.
Right. Yeah. And that's again, something that we have talked about in previous episodes as well, as something that could potentially lead somebody to joining a cult like this.
The Order of the Solar Temple actually had some apocalyptic views, and the leadership felt that the Solar Temple was being persecuted by various governments, and they anticipated an imminent end of the world due to an environmental catastrophe, and felt that they were to play a major role in the collapse. They decided that some members should leave the Earth prematurely and transit to a better world. And fire formed an important part of their belief, and they believed that the world would end in fire, and in order for them to transit to another world, they must die in a fire. So they definitely had some very askew worldviews. Now, the whole thing about environmental catastrophe might be right, because we're kind of living in that right now. You know.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. It was like 96 degrees here today. So
today, another newsworthy day for July 28th, because today there was actually one of the top news stories today was that 17,000 climate scientists have all signed an agreement saying that we are past the point of no return, that they believe that we are now in a point where we can no longer recover without dramatic changes being done on a worldwide level. And wow. That, we're headed toward irreversible problems. And they're talking about, nearly an immediate 3-meter sea level rise, and it could be as much as 30 meters. And that's, that puts Miami underwater. So,
yeah, that was my thought. Goodbye, New Orleans. Better go visit in the next year or so, I guess. But I mean, on a serious note, yeah, wow, that's very, very sobering information and something to
we've always seen these kind of apocalyptic end of world views, and it always comes down to something environmental, and there's fire as a common theme. Nostradamus had a lot of fire and environmental themes in his prophecies. So are these delusional thoughts, this kind of stuff, is this so pyrophobia is fear of fire, right? And then I know there are also doomsday phobias. I want to talk for a minute about phobias and this type of thinking. Is this just a scare tactic in the cult to get your members to believe in your authority more by creating fear? Are these delusional thoughts that people think and dwell on how the world's going to end? Are these phobias, and how are phobias treated generally in the world of psychology?
Again, it's a little bit hard to say without more specific information about each person and their own beliefs, but it's almost kind of a combination, it seems like, of, fear plus potentially some delusional or magical thinking there. And phobias in psychology are treated with an exposure to the feared stimulus or, item, or if it's fire, then you would expose somebody to fire towards the end of that treatment, but you would start out with something that was a lot less fear inducing so that you could work your way up to that. So there is something called flooding where you could just, someone is terrified of fire and you just, light a candle on fire or take them to a bonfire. And then all of that anxiety just kind of explodes within them all at once. And then the idea is that, we always think about anxiety in any emotion as it kind of ramps up. There's a peak, and that's usually where people want to bail, because that's where your body starts to tell you that you're in danger. Right. And this can happen with emotions, as well as things like anxiety and fear. But what happens is when you bail because you're at that point, then that reinforces the fear. And so then you're kind of stuck in the cycle, and that creates this phobia. And so, if you sit with that long enough, it will eventually come down, believe it or not. And so if you tell most people with horrible anxiety or phobia that they won't believe you because they've been reinforcing this fear and anxiety so long that it's really hard for them to believe that if they sat with that horrible feeling long enough, that it would actually start to go away. But it does. So that's the approach that's generally taken in psychology.
Can you create a phobia in someone? How do they come on?
You can. And so there's a famous experiment where with little Albert was the child's name. And so they created a phobia of rabbits, basically, in this child by giving him, little fluffy white stuffed animal. And then they, moved it to maybe a rat or something like this. I don't know if I'm getting the details correct. I haven't thought about this in a couple of years, but and then a rabbit, and they would, do something jarring anytime that the child would go to touch this little white furry animal. And so then the child started to become horrified of, right, this rabbit, and then any other items or animals or things that looked similar to it. So we call that generalization. So you start to, this fear of this specific thing starts to then translate into a fear of these other things that are similar. So if you're terrified of a white rabbit, then you might start to be terrified of a white rat or a, white fluffy pillow, or even like a white fluffy cotton ball, something like that.
So as we start to dissect these cults from episode to episode, is it possible that the leadership of these cults, in an effort to kind of program their members, could create a phobia of, being afraid of a government, being afraid of, the end of the world, being, you know what I mean? Like, is this a system of programming potentially?
That's a really good question. I think potentially, yes. I mean, because if you're putting this, if the people are primed to listen to these people that are the cult leaders, and they are continuing to tell them these things that induce this really high level of fear and anxiety, and then they're reinforcing that by doing other things, then it does kind of act as a way to use fear mongering essentially on some level to get people into the state where they are terrified to do anything outside of what these cult leaders are telling them to do, in fear that that something really horrible is going to happen, because like you said, they've kind of been programmed to think that at that point.
Is there a difference in a belief system and a delusional thought? I mean, using my own medical terminology, we've come across a lot of wackadoodle cults. and some of their belief systems are just like, really? That's what you believe? Like, you might as well be believing in Bugs Bunny, because some of them are just so out there. It's like, how can anyone, where did the gullibility train pull up and let all these people off? Because it's crazy. Now, not that necessarily the Solar Temple is one of the most wackadoodle ones that I've come across, but but when is a belief system so convoluted that it is almost delusional? Is there a difference? Is there a middle ground? Is it a spectrum? How would you consider that?
So I would say when we're thinking about delusional thoughts, or some kind of magical thinking, it's really that the thoughts and ideas are based outside of what we see as reality. And the important caveat to that is that it's generally agreed upon by everyone that this is reality and that this is what's happening. And that includes cultural aspects as well. So we have to think about that. But culture envelops religion and spirituality, obviously. So that's where I think that deviates. So delusional thinking then would not be, it would even be outside of the realm of what other people that practice various religions or spiritual practices would agree on as being based in reality as well.
It's interesting to me, because I'm going to just use the Christians and the Jewish as an example. I once attended kind of this meeting that was supposed to create Jewish and Catholic harmony. And I sat at this meeting and I listened to these people go back and forth trying to understand the other person's religion. And it was very odd to me because of how rabbis have a real lack of training. Priests have an extensive amount of training. Nearly anyone can be a rabbi. It's a very limited group of people that can be priests. And most of the people that attended this meeting were very old. So from the Christian side, a lot of it was not understanding Jewish holidays. And from the Jewish side, it was not understanding these Christian holidays. And I just, for an hour, they went back and forth on all these like just idiotic points. And finally, I'm very confrontational with some of the stuff. And I raised my hand and I said, look, guys, we got to cut to what's really important here. And that is that the Jewish don't believe Christ was real. And in most cases, don't believe he even existed. And especially they don't believe that Christ was the Son of God. So how do you get past this, right? That there's such a fundamental disregard to that, you know, the Jewish kind of think Jesus is Mickey Mouse. How do you like, and these are major, major religious systems in the world. And yet that difference between the Christians might be delusional for worshiping someone who they don't even believe existed as a human being is such an odd thing to me. The difference between belief systems and what's delusional. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
we're looking at a very fine-tuned look at the solar temple, but this happens even on the largest scales.
Yes, and I think that that's the difference, is that if you're arguing about whether or not someone was an actual person, there's evidence that you can look at for and against that on either side, but this idea that this person existed or not, there's enough evidence there that we can say that this argument is still based in some level of reality. And so delusion really veers far outside of that, if that makes sense, because both of those groups, those are still comprised of large groups of people that believe one way or the other.
Right.
So,
it's interesting. It's always interesting to think that stuff through, I think.
Oh yeah, I agree. Yes.
I'm going to talk
about food for thought.
I'm going to talk about their missions and their beliefs. The aim of the Order of the Solar Temple was to establish correct notions of authority and power in the world. They wanted an affirmation of the primacy of the spiritual over the temporal, assisting humanity through a great transition and preparing for the second coming of Christ as a solar God King, and furthering a unification of all Christian churches and Islam. So all kind of interesting. The group reportedly drew some inspiration for its teachings from the British occultist Aleister Crowley, who headed the Order of the Eastern Temple. And of course, you know, you've already heard earlier that this was already an amalgam of different little groups anyways, and philosophies that, that Luke had. So again, more ingredients to the making of the cult.
Yeah, definitely. I was just thinking about, you know, the aims, the goals of this, and, the spiritual piece, and this idea that that death is more of just a transition as opposed to an end to something is pretty interesting to me as well.
Aleister Crowley was a famous English occultist. He was a ceremonial magician. He was a poet, a painter, a novelist. He's very famous. Many people have probably heard of him that might be listening to this, but he was deep into creating these pagan religions. And he identified himself as a prophet and felt like he was a guide for humanity. And I think, you know, people are still kind of rewriting the history behind who Aleister Crowley was and if he was good or evil. So that some of Crawley's influence made its way into this is a little frightening.
Yes, I was thinking about that too. And I kind of wish that I knew more information about him, because I've also heard of him. But I don't know enough specific information to put any thoughts together, but I'll have to read a little bit more about that after we're done here too. That's an interesting point.
I'm going to go ahead and read into your next part here, but there were solar temple lodges in Quebec, Canada, as well as in Australia, Switzerland, Martinique, other countries. The temple's activities were a mix of kind of this early Christian identity, the UFO religion, New Age philosophy, and they adapted a lot of Freemason rituals. The order was interested in attractive, wealthy, and influential members. And it was reputed to have several affluent Europeans who were secret members of the group. So again, all ingredients in making a cult.
Yes. And it's funny to me that we keep seeing this piece come up as well, that you really need some people who are wealthy or influential if you want to get your cult off the ground.
Yeah.
That seems to be a really important piece. So that kind of lends to just some additional questions about how those
put together,
would get attracted.
Yeah. What I put together here, which I think is really the main course of all of this, and that is there are multiple locations on different continents. They have a doctrine. They have a mission and a goal. They have enigmatic leadership. They have questionable philosophies, and we're going to find out a little bit more as this podcast goes on, but they have a lot of money and clearly attracting the people that have the money. So they have all the magical ingredients of creating a cult.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Let's get into the structure of the cult a little bit more. According to the literature of the OTS, the central authority was the Synarchy of the Temple, whose membership was secret. Its top 33 members were known as the Elder Brothers of the Rossi Cross and were headquartered in Zurich, Switzerland. The Council of the Order formed lodges that were run by regional commanders and three elders. Progression in the order was by levels and grades, with three grades per level.
There were many organizations associated with the OTS, all of which offered the teachings of Luc Giraud both to the general public and privately to OTS members. The lodges had altars, rituals, and costumes. Members were initiated at each stage of the advancement and ceremonies, which included expensive purchases, jewelry, costumes, regalia, and the payment of initiation fees. During ceremonies, members wore crusader-type robes and were to hold in awe a sword, which Demombro said was an authentic Templar artifact given to him 1,000 years ago in a previous life.
I'm glad, you know, after he died, that he preserved the sword for himself, so as he came back, he could then retrieve said sword he owned and use it for this purpose.
Yeah, this is very showy, it sounds like, to me. Jewelry, regalia, a sword. I mean, there's a lot going on there.
This is more ingredients for making a cult, which is really what this, you know, this podcast is kind of about. And you know, levels of command are always a good system of control and sort of necessary in a cult because it activates the reward center of your brain. Advancement and leveling up, being commended for acts, is like a drug for people. That's why you have belts in martial arts, because if you don't feel like you have any achievement, you just do the same old thing for 9 or 10 years. And then one day they say you're a black belt. Like, that doesn't work. You will continue to spend money if you are leveling up. And I think this whole level system and this chain of command is important and needed for a cult, to especially one that's going to spread around the world, because you can already see how this is different from the Manson cult. Manson didn't have money. Thank God he didn't have money. Could you imagine what Manson would have done if he had $1 billion at his disposal? What would have happened?
I'm glad that, you know, the people in Hollywood and the Beach Boys did not like Manson enough to keep him around too long, because right. I think, yeah, if he was charming with people who had money, he would have been a lot more dangerous. Isn't that interesting, though, that he was much more charming and, like you said, enigmatic and kind of seen that way by these people that were not as well off. And those are the people that kind of flocked to him, as opposed to what we are seeing more here, it seems like.
The producers and the people that were around Manson were kind of creeped out by him. They didn't like having him around. And like, yeah, even Dennis Wilson didn't like having Manson crash at his house because he was throwing parties and trashing stuff. And he just, you know, like this, they definitely wanted to get him out of their life. And that's why he, you know, he did record an album. He did have songs and things like that, but he rubbed all those people the wrong way. So he attracted what he could attract.
Yeah. And isn't it interesting that, you know, he wanted that fame and notoriety in a different way at first through Hollywood or music or whatever it would have been. And then, you know, even though he was a piece of crap, he ended up still actually getting that fame and notoriety just in a different way.
He did. He did.
So
people will be talking about him in another 50 years, in another 100 years.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
It's interesting because if you go back, you know, over 100 years ago, and you go back to a time, you know, 130 years ago when Billy the Kid was around, Billy the Kid was really just a serial killer. But we've romanticized him in books and movies and all this stuff for all this time. And today he's just like the outlaw cowboy. But really, he was pretty much a murderer. That's what he did. You know, he was just a thug outlaw that shot people and killed people. And he was a minor at that.
Yeah, that's a great point. I had never really thought about that way, because you're right. It's how we talk about it as a society, and just culturally learning that as we grow up, and movies and Hollywood kind of embellishes that story, like you're saying. And then we start to think about this person in a completely different way than we would if, you know, the lens had been that he was just a serial killer, and that's story had always been.
I think you see a kind of a romanticizing of these characters in a way, like even in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Tarantino has Charles Manson show up and he's got his bell bottoms on and they have a good looking actor playing him and he's all friendly. Hey man, is, you know, so-and-so home? And he's talking to Brad Pitt. And it's like, why can't you do a movie where you make Manson absolutely repulsive to where when the audience sees him on screen, your skin crawls, like you don't want to be near him, you know? But they don't. They don't, yeah. You know, they make him into the cool hippie guy. And it's like, well, if this is going to be the continued telling of the story in 100 years, who knows what people will think of Charles Manson? He could be thought of like Billy the Kid.
Yeah, I actually think that's a really good parallel to draw. I hadn't thought about that before you just brought it up. But I mean, I would agree with you. And
this is how screwed up our society is.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're getting away from the Order of the Solar Temple, but one more thing I want to say about kind of the making of this cult is also the relic, I think, is really important. I don't believe for a second, obviously, not an ounce of me thinks that this sword belonged to him in a past life. This is clearly something that was used to reinforce the ideas of the cult. And even if the relic was fake, it gives you a sense of history with the cult. And I think that's all important. And the robes and the ceremony and all this pomp and circumstance all feeds into the idea of a cult. Now, I will just to kind of step aside from this in a minute. I don't want to say that like a Mason Lodge or Knights of Columbus Hall, you know, these organizations you can join that have some religious roots, they do ceremonial stuff like that. Even fraternities and sororities in the Greek world have ceremonies. But
oh, yeah.
So that doesn't make something a cult necessarily, but when you put it next to all of these other things that are happening, again, it's all the ingredients to make this thing.
Exactly.
And also I think, you know, a lot of these fraternal organizations are for charitable work, and they're for, you know, making friends and, you know, having a brotherhood or a sisterhood versus groups like this that have a directive that they want to accomplish, which we've talked about, you know, that how they want to affect change in society, usher in the end. I mean, their ideas are pretty clear.
Yeah. I really like that you brought that point up about creating some sense of history. I think that really does make a huge difference when we're thinking about creating this sense of trust within a cult. And if you are thinking about something that is brand new, well, you're probably not going to trust that nearly as much as something that seems like there's a lot of history behind it, even if it's questionable. So that's a really great point.
Yeah. Now we get into the dark part of this, and that is the murders and the suicides. So we're going to see how all this all goes to crap.
Yeah. I mean, we knew this was coming at some point, I guess.
In October of 1994, at their Canadian site, an infant, aged 3 months, was stabbed repeatedly with a wooden stake. Well, that's how we're coming into this, Dr. Katie.
Yes, I know. I'm like, I don't even mean to laugh. I just am laughing because it's, you know, it's just so dark that on some level I do that to try to lighten it up for myself and, you know, give a little relief, because we are talking about things that are really dark and heavy. And so I tend to try to throw a little humor in there just to try to lighten it up a bit.
Well, you know, in modern history, I don't expect to be saying a sentence like that.
Yeah.
I mean, am I reading something from Bram Stoker here? What's going on? I don't understand what's happening, because, you know, stabbed repeatedly with a wooden stake. Like, how often do you ever say that in the 90s, right? Yeah. And former group members actually explained that DeMombro ordered the killing because the baby was believed to be the Antichrist described in the Bible. And he believed that the Antichrist was born into the order to prevent him from succeeding in his spiritual aim. A few days later, DeMombro and 12 followers had a ritual Last Supper together. A few days after that, mass suicides and murders were conducted at two villages in Switzerland and in Morin Heights, a ski resort north of Montreal, Quebec. 15 Inner Circle members, called the Awakened, committed suicide by the use of poison, and 30, called the Immortals, were killed by bullets or smothering. 8 others, called the Traitors, were also killed.
And so on December 16th, 1995, close to the winter solstice, 16 of the remaining members of the group disappeared from their homes in France and Switzerland. 4 left notes which hinted at a second mass suicide and expressed a desire to see another world. 13 adults and 3 children were later found dead in a remote forest on the Vergers Plateau in southeast France. Investigators concluded that at least 4 of the 16 did not die willingly. 3 were children. The 4th had her jaw fractured before she died. So this indicates that clearly some kind of a struggle had occurred here. Most had been given sleep-inducing drugs. And during the trial, it was discovered that 2 of the members had shot the others, including 3 children, aged 18 months, 2 years, and 4 years. The 2 men also poured gasoline all over the bodies, set them on fire, shot themselves, and fell into the flames. One of the dead included Olympian Edith Bonlieu, who had competed in the women's downhill at the 1956 Winter Olympics.
5 additional adult members and 3 teenage children apparently tried to commit suicide on the day of the spring equinox on March 20th, 1997, in St. Casimir, Quebec, Canada. The attempt failed due to faulty equipment. It's unclear what the equipment was. The teenage sons and daughter of one of the couples convinced their parents that they wanted to live. They were allowed to leave while the adults made their second successful attempt at suicide and burned down the house with themselves in it. 4 of their bodies were arranged in the form of a cross. The teens were found drugged and disoriented, but otherwise safe. A note was found there which described the group belief that death on Earth leads to a transit to a new planet where their lives would continue. Wow.
Yeah.
This is something.
It's a lot to digest there, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So I guess, you know, I'm wondering, first off, what I'm wondering is these are murders that involve, you know, adults killing adults, adults killing children. So yes. Let's kind of dig into the kind of the true crime element of this, which we don't usually get into much, but I'm wondering, is there a difference in the mind of a person that can murder a child versus murdering an adult?
So I'm not 100% sure about, you know, what the research would say on that, or if there is research on that. But I would say that there's likely some kind of a difference in someone who is an adult, who can kill another adult, someone that could potentially fight back against them, right? Versus someone who is murdering a child, or someone that is not able to fight back against them for whatever reason. So there's some, you know, power differential at play there, more so than there is between, you know, an adult murdering an adult. And so for me, just, you know, anecdotally thinking out loud, I would say probably yes. And just, you know, the level of violence with this as well is something to bring up. So, I mean, this isn't like they all drank the Kool-Aid and then fell asleep. This is, you know, I mean, a lot of violence and fire and shooting and stabbing and, like you said, very young children. And so that seems very personal and would indicate to me some lack of empathy. Because if you do think that you have to kill yourself to be able to, or that you just need to die to be able to move on to a life on another planet, okay, but do you need to do it so violently? And I right. guess, you know, fire is a big part of this, and they talk about that in this cult as being a central piece. But it's just still a lot of violence that doesn't even have to do with fire.
Well, you know, there are suicide cults, some of which we'll be covering. And, you know, there are some of the UFO cults where people, you know, poisoned themselves and went to sleep, you know, nicely arranged in their bunk beds, wanting to go up in the mothership. Like, there are those suicide cults that they just, you know, people are just going to sleep. Even Jim Jones's ministry, they, you know, poisoned people with cyanide, which they thought would make people just go to sleep. Instead, it was a violent, violent, right. awful way to go.
But just thought about that after I said that too.
At least maybe a little bit more humanely than suffocating people with plastic and putting bullets in their heads. And, you know, and I think it's interesting. And maybe at some point we'll find a specialist out there who can be a guest on our show and maybe explain this to us better. But it's fascinating to me, the idea that someone could kill another person, you know, an adult male killing another adult male versus an adult male that can kill a child. And also the difference in a person who can be a murderer and also kill themselves. A lot of people will murder others, but they would never turn the gun on themselves. They're terrified of suicide. And there's a lot of people that could easily kill themselves, commit suicide, but could never harm another person. I'm sure there's some scale or chart or grading system that discusses this, wouldn't you think?
Yes, I feel like there's probably an abundance of research about that. And so that's definitely something that I'll have to look into, especially moving forward as we continue to record and talk about, you know, the differences between these different types of cults, you know, suicide focus versus more murder and that type of thing.
One of the things that fascinates me about the Order of the Solar Temple is that there just wasn't one person committing the murders. There were a lot of people in the leadership that did this. And I'm wondering how a cult could generate so many members that were able to commit murder. You know, we know that Manson instructed several of his members to commit crimes and commit murders. And, you know, Tex Watson was part of that. Some of the girls were part of that. And they went in with knives and guns and, you know, different things to kill these people. Yet Manson did not do it. Maybe he was a coward. Maybe he wasn't a violent person like that. And he just picked the people that were right for the job. But in this particular case, how were so many people bred to be murderers in a cult like this? And apparently one that maybe wasn't ruled by drugs. Like, you know, we know Manson wanted his people in a zombie-like state. These are people that tended to be in the business world. There was one of the people that died was an Olympian. Another person that died was a mayor of a town. You know, like, I know some of these people were murdered, but they still willingly die. Like, what's going on here? Is this brainwashing? Is brainwashing real? Is there some proof that brainwashing can really exist?
Yes. So brainwashing is definitely something that can happen. I mean, there are a lot of pieces that go along with that, including, you know, like I said earlier, this idea of a power differential that usually goes along with this idea of brainwashing as well. And then there's usually some level of traumatic event or, you know, thinking that is potentially based around fear. And so then when you combine those things and have someone that is very convicted in what they're saying about the end of the world, and this is what we have to do, and these people are kind of being broken down and, you know, rebuilt, so to speak, which is kind of what we think about when we think about this idea of brainwashing. It's, you know, a psychological and even sometimes a physical breaking down of a person so that they question who they are, what they actually think, so that they can be sort of built back up, so to speak, by these leaders or these other people that want to have control and power over them. And so then they are able to insert these ideas that they have into this person that's been broken down or brainwashed. And then this person starts to take on that identity as their own and these thoughts as their own. But, you know, it's a combination of things that really leads to that happening. And I do believe that that could be something that really could push someone to commit a murder if they, you know, if it was a severe enough level of brainwashing or, you know, manipulating someone to believe that this is what they have to do to be able to get where they have to be. You know, if you thought that you were going to be able to live somewhere else in this euphoric state with all these other people that you cared about, and this is what you had to do to make that happen because the world was going to end anyway, then, you know, maybe you would commit a murder.
Yeah. You know, when I hear about people brainwashed to commit a murder, you know, I think of this, all this Manchurian Candidate kind of stuff. Like it's like secret government stuff to me. Like I wouldn't be sure if a cult could do this. Like I get it with Manson and his drug induced, you know, you can get someone on, you know, PCP to nearly do anything. Like you could get someone so screwed up that you could probably, you know, make them walk into traffic or pretty much do anything you say because they're not thinking for themselves at a certain point possibly. But we don't have any clear evidence that the Order of the Solar Temple put people through some strenuous brainwashing thing. It seems that they're just adopting the doctrine of this. So right. It was that easy to push them toward, hey, today's the day. And, you know, everyone knows it's coming. There's a lot of, you know, because these buildings were burned down, there wasn't a lot of evidence. And part of the problem in, you know, kind of what we've put together for today's episode is we really can't get much information from the French government and from the Swiss and the Canadians. They're not as forthcoming with data like we are here, where you can put in kind of a Freedom of Information Act request to get nearly anything you want on a governmental level. Other countries don't do that. So there's a whole lot of evidence that's never been given out by the police departments and you know, these, you know, state and country investigations that went on. So we have very little to actually say what the inner workings of, you know, what was really going on in this, and hardly anyone left alive that could talk about it. And the kids that survived, I tried to look for them. I can't even find them. So they may be under assumed names. They might be dead now. Who knows where these people are at?
Yeah.
But it's interesting to me. So moving in kind of the aftermath of this, in all, 74 followers were massacred. A couple other interesting points is, for many months prior to the murder suicides, there were rumors of financial mismanagement within the Solar Temple. So that might have sped up their reason for exiting the world. You know, as we know, a lot of these cults, they get in money problems. You know, they spend money, and the people, the leadership, you know, they take it for themselves in some cases. So, or maybe there were disagreements in the two leaders. It's hard to say.
And I actually, that's a point that I was just thinking about earlier too. I almost wonder, you know, once you get to a certain level of status in society and have a certain level of wealth, do you think that that's something that also potentially could be a variable that could impact whether or not somebody joins a cult? You know, are you bored with everything else that's going on? You kind of have everything. You can do a lot of things already. You're looking for some other kind of mental stimulation, and you happen upon this cult, and maybe you're someone that sees yourself as being very open-minded. And so you go and, you know, listen to these people speak, and they're very charismatic. And then you start to think, well, maybe this is something that I could be interested in and involved in.
Well, you're talking about Scientology. So.
Yeah, right. So I do think, potentially for some of these cults, and maybe this one, that is something that also contributed to this.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because, you know, I can look at it on a couple levels. You know, Scientology is always the thing all the celebrities gravitate toward. I know so many celebrities that have gone and taken classes on all levels of their careers. And that's fascinating to me. And then I kind of think about stuff like this. I remember a study I read that was conducted in the late 80s, and it was about Michael Jackson. And at Michael Jackson's career peak, at the Thriller album, Bad Album time frame, when he was on top of the world, he had so many voting age fans that he could influence an election. If he told his fans, go vote for this person, this candidate would win on a popular vote. That's how many fans he had, right?
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Not to mention what he would say would resonate around the world. He was so popular. Now, we haven't had an entertainer of that level since Michael Jackson, but imagine, you know, Kanye West did his Christian music, right? And he would have his prayer circles. You know, he would like have people show up at his concerts and pray with him and like have a service. He would go to parks and conduct services. But what if Kanye wasn't doing it from a Christian perspective and just said, I'm going to start my own religion? He would immediately have followers, wouldn't he? Immediately.
Yes, I would think so.
That's how powerful some of these people are.
Oh, yeah. I also feel like that's probably not too far out of the realm of possibility, unfortunately, for Kanye. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that I think contributes to this.
The record seized by Quebec police showed that some members had actually personally donated over $1 million to Demombro. So there was definitely money there, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it seems that way.
And we know all the leadership pretty much died in the fires and the murder suicides. Police decided not to charge the three teenage survivors of the St. Casimir mass suicide with arson. They were aged 13, 14, and 16 at the time. And although they did trigger the incendiary device, they were under the influence of sedatives at the time and had been psychologically affected by living with the members of the Solar Temple group. And other factors considered by the prosecutor were that they tried to persuade the adults not to commit suicide and that they chose life for themselves. So really, some of the only people to survive the initial cult were these three minors. And pretty much that's all there were from the original group.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that they decided not to charge them. I feel like they probably had been through enough, especially at that age, 13, 14, and 16. I mean, and I can't imagine if they had been a part of that cult somehow, you know, for years prior to that, or any amount of time prior to that, how that impacted them.
The leadership was dead. The founders of the cult were dead, but the police did arrest Michael Tabachnik, who is an internationally renowned Swiss musician and conductor. And he was arrested as the leader of the Solar Temple, one of the only remaining people in the late 90s. And he was indicted for participation in a criminal organization and murder. And he came to trial in Grenoble, France during the spring of 2001 and was acquitted. French prosecutors appealed against the verdict, and the appellate court ordered a second trial beginning on October 24th of 2006. And he was again cleared less than 2 months later in December. In 2008, Tabachnik became the new music director and chief conductor of the Brussels Philharmonic. So one of the last people in charge is still a respected musician and conductor and may have been a murderer. You never
Isn't
know.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, again, it just really speaks to if you have a certain level of wealth and it comes with a certain level of power and influence and probably a way to potentially get out of being charged or convicted of certain things, in my opinion.
Crazy to think that this guy's, and I believe this guy is like close to 80 years old now, maybe a little bit older than that. And he's still, he's still out there, and he may have been part of these murder suicides. We can't say that on this podcast exactly we think that he was. We don't know. We have no proof, but someone is left alive that was part of that. And of course, because the court systems don't release any information, we have no idea what went on in the trial or what evidence was shown one way or another. So he may have had no involvement. He may have been the guy polishing the sword and had no idea what was going on anywhere else. You know,
he's cleaning the dust off the robes and just, I didn't see anything.
The scary part about all this is that the Solar Temple group continues to exist. And it's believed to have over 30 surviving members in Quebec and from 140 to 500 worldwide. So just when we think this is over, that everyone's dead, this is still functioning. They've taken this doctrine and are continuing to work with it. And we've talked about Nexium. We talked about it at the beginning of the episode. But one of the things that I think is really interesting is that, you know, all this is pretty much over and done now. I think there might only be one or two more verdicts that have to come out for people to be punished. But there is patented technology. There is intellectual property that was created. And whether Keith Raniere ever sees the light of day at all, that content is still out there somewhere, especially today with the internet. You can keep this data, this executive sex program alive, this executive success program alive anywhere in the world by just uploading documents. So,
I know I've said this already, but I really am looking forward to diving into that specific cult just because we have so much information because it's more recent. But all of this wealth, power, information. I mean, he really created a huge amount of content that not all of his ideas were completely outlandish either. And so it will be interesting to see how that progresses as we move forward and how people use that.
Well, whatever is going on with the Solar Temple now, I don't know if they're still following the same mission you know, if the people that are out there are still thinking the world's going to come to an end in a certain way, and whether you have to die by fire, when they're going to pull the trigger on this, will we hear another version of this in 10 years of mass suicides? Who knows? But if this group is still functioning, it is deep underground because there's no public front. There's no website to go to and join it. So
yeah,
how you join it, how you get in it, I have no idea.
Yeah. I wonder if it is something that's become very secretive and you really have to know somebody who knows somebody to be a part of it.
Yeah.
Which could also be a draw to a cult.
Yeah. You know, like the Masons and some of these other groups, they do have websites, right? So they're not so secretive, but you can't really join it from the website. You still have to be recommended by someone that's in the group. I was actually asked to join the Masons. A friend of mine was a Mason and he was like, I want to invite you to join the group. And I was like, yeah, I want to figure out what's going on, you know? But I was rejected because at the time I was married and my wife was Latina. And you couldn't have Latina wife. It was completely white organization. So I was rejected because of the race of my wife.
Well, that sounds a little problematic. But I'm glad that you didn't join if that's the basis on which they're
I was interested in ascending in the secret society for the sake of my research, but no, thwarted.
Inside info, I know.
And of course, and I believe you can't join it if you're divorced either. So I think now it's like a double whammy for me. I'll never be able to join it. So I'll never get to the bottom of the secret organization that so many presidents were part of.
Oh, yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah.
Well, that wraps up our Order of the Solar Temple. What do you think about that?
Very interesting. This one, like we said at the beginning, was really different in some ways than the others that we've talked about so far. And, you know, each of the cults that we will talk about will all be slightly different. But this one is, I think, one that probably not a lot of people have heard about, and something that's really just an interesting combination of things, of, you know, this kind of delusional thinking and all these other potential traits that we've talked about that create this perfect storm of a cult leader, but also all this money and wealth and people that joined on their own, and then all of these gruesome murders and suicides, and the fact that it's still going on today, and that there's even somebody that potentially was a part of it that is still alive, and, you know, now the head of the Brussels Philharmonic, even.
Right. I just like that we can go episode to episode and just not show America as the screwed up country where all this stuff goes on. This actually goes on all over the world, people.
Yes, that's true. That is a good point.
They're just as messed up in France and Belgium and Switzerland and, you know, all these other countries that we're talking about. Panama, which we did last time. And this happens everywhere.
Yeah, it's just a little bit of a different approach to each cult, you know, and I'm sure that culture and geography plays into that on some level.
I think it'll be interesting when we wrap up this limited series, if we maybe do kind of a follow-up episode where we go back and what did we learn from all this? You know, what were the commonalities? What really were they? You know, if there was a scoreboard to things that had to be happening here, what was it that made these things go wrong? Because some of these, it's the sex that went wrong. Sometimes it's the drugs that went wrong. Sometimes it was the murders or the suicides or the guns or whatever it was. Something made these things go astray. And sometimes it was one thing and sometimes it was multiple things. But, you know, the Catholic Church didn't topple with a priest scandal. And it wasn't one priest. It was a lot of priests that were responsible for homosexual behavior, with molesting children. Like, this was widespread and it didn't topple the Catholics, but this is a large religion, right? And these are smaller cults, but you see a lot of the same common activity that happens, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good thing to think about as we move forward and talk about these cults as well. And, you know, how are they different than these religious groups and that have potentially had some of the same problematic things happen.
Yeah. Well, this has been a good one. We have a lot more to go. So we're not even halfway through the season yet. So people, we have some really cool stuff coming up. I hope you enjoyed this one. You know, as usual, you can go to anchor.fm cult following to find us. We are also available on Facebook and Instagram at Join the Cult Following. If you have questions or comments, you can leave us a voicemail on our Anchor site, or you can send us an email at jointhecultfollowing@gmail.com. And for me, Todd, you can reach me, you know, on virtually any social media platform as myself, Todd Fisher, or under my company, Metatomics. So just look for at Metatomics at pretty much everything and you'll get me. And what about you, Dr. Katie? How can people get you?
You can find me at my website, which is drkatiesays.com. And you can also search Dr. Katie Says on all social media platforms. Most active right now on Instagram, but that is to be changing shortly. So just, you know, give me a follow. I love to see new people. And until then, keep following.
We'll see you soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Metacortex Publishing hopes that you've enjoyed this presentation.
Please take a moment to listen to some other podcast offerings from Metacortex Publishing.
A quest is a search for something. And every week, the Quest podcast will show you how we know what we know through interviews with people that have incredible stories of dedication and perseverance. I'm your host, Todd Fisher. Join me in this thought-provoking and inspiring podcast of discovery. Find us anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Father Daniel DePlantis, a Catholic priest, martial artist, and host of the Karate Priest podcast. Have you ever wondered what the church teaches about different topics? Are you a martial arts enthusiast or just someone who wants to learn more about martial arts? I'd like to invite you to join me and many guests on my podcast as we cover topics of faith, everyday living, and martial arts on the Karate Priest podcast.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review this episode. This podcast is produced by Todd Fisher and Anthony Smith and is distributed by Metacortex Publishing. This podcast is copyright. Any previously trademarked or copyright content is used by permission. Information and opinions stated in this podcast should not be construed as medical advice. Please be sure to visit the official website for Metacortex Publishing at metacortexpublishing.com or find us on social media for other unique content.